Good morning, everyone. I'll go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here. We have one public hearing and work session scheduled for today, House Bill 4135. We also have a work session scheduled for House Bill 4145A. Since I do not have all my members here, I think what we'll go ahead and do is start with the public hearing on House Bill 4135A. So I'll open up that public hearing. And Chana?
Chair Przelinski, members of the committee, House Bill 4135 modifies the Oregon Advanced Directive form. It establishes a 13-member Advanced Directive Adoption Committee to propose modifications to the instruction portion of the Oregon Advanced Directive form on a four-year cycle. It requires this proposal from the committee to be submitted to an interim committee on judiciary and then directs the committee to introduce proposed legislative measures by which the form may be ratified. It enumerates the provisions that must be included into the instruction portion of the form and considered by the adoption committee. And it updates the witnessing requirements to the current form and allows for use of notarization in lieu of two witnesses.
All right, thank you. So I'm going to first call up our first panel. We'll be alternating back and forth. The first one will be Nick Kotler, also Jessica Adamson, and Chris Hamilton.
So, Chair Przelinski and members of the committee, good morning.
I don't think so.
For the record, my name is Nick Kotler, and I'm the Regional Director for the Providence Center for Healthcare Ethics. It is an honor and a privilege to be with you this morning to share on behalf of Providence our strong support for HB 4135. Today, I speak to you from the perspective of a clinical ethicist who practices in Providence's Catholic healthcare ministries, including hospitals, clinics, home health, hospice, and ambulatory care centers across Oregon. Ethicists support patients and families and healthcare professionals through complex, value-laden decisions in circumstances of ambiguity and disagreement. I'm drawing on my experience in such clinical ethics consultations, which often occur in conjunction with our palliative care colleagues. We believe that well-documented, values-based advanced care planning in the form of a valid advanced directive is an extraordinary gift that one person can share with loved ones. An advanced directive helps alleviate the burdens and moral distress of making healthcare decisions on behalf of incapacitated persons facing life-threatening illness. Entrusting someone by explicitly designating them and granting them authority to make your healthcare decisions is an awe-inspiring decision. As healthcare representative or as professional caregiver, having access to a statement of values is tremendous help in ensuring appropriate medical care is delivered in alignment with patient preferences. This vision for best practices in advanced care planning is hindered by the current form that has been locked in statute for more than 25 years. In our consultation service, we encounter many types of issues with the current form. As caregivers, we lament situations wherein a family member must make her best guess about what the patient would want. Does the patient want mechanical ventilation, even though it is unlikely he will be able to breathe on his own again? In the absence of an advance directive, which are often not completed because of the confusing form, healthcare professionals may turn to a family member by default, and it may not be the person the patient would trust most to make decisions on her behalf. Countless consults involve navigating these complex decisions and care planning with individuals who have only their own glimpse of what the patient would want. Estranged family members are often called upon after years of separation only to confront a heart-wrenching decision at the end of life. Even with designating a healthcare representative, we lament situations wherein family members struggle to discern how to best represent the patient's checkbox instructions. Healthcare representatives of a stroke patient are often facing agonizing decisions about life support in the face of uncertain and often improbable recovery. A box checked for no life support may preclude the possibility of recovery. Providence strongly supports House Bill 4135 because it creates a process by which the community can improve the advanced directive form in Oregon. Such a process will enable Oregonians to complete more user-friendly advanced directives that allow greater opportunities to express values and reasons behind a stated preference. The new form created under this process holds the promise of greater usefulness for family and loved ones, healthcare professionals, and the patients themselves. The process will allow the form to be more readily updated in response to language preferences and changing medical technology. Thank you for your time and support of House Bill 4135.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. I'm here today to talk from a consumer perspective. Our colleagues at AARP and Disability Rights Oregon, unfortunately, were unable to be here this morning because of weather in Portland, but they have been integral parts of the conversations over the last 4 years that have brought us to this bill. For consumers, the current form lacks, while groundbreaking 30 years ago when it was first passed, today it lacks the plain language and consumer-friendly standards that we know as healthcare professionals that really matter when patients are filling these out. As you've heard from my colleague, many, many patients get stuck, even when working with an attorney or in well in advance. It becomes really hard to try and figure out in a form that is not built around values, that's not built around simple to understand language, that is easy for a consumer to make those decisions, that is requires a checkbox approach to very complicated decisions. It doesn't serve the consumer. Doesn't serve their families. And so this process is about taking that instructions form, getting a group of really well-qualified experts from long-term care, the legal community, the healthcare community, ethicists together to find a way to create a form that is consumer-centric, that makes sure that people can share their values, whether they be religious or not, to help people at any age of life describe how they want to live if they're incapacitated. It's important to remember that incapacity can happen at the very end of life, but it can also happen when people in their 30s or 40s have a car accident and they can no longer speak for themselves or have some grave illness and are no longer able to make decisions on their own. So these forms are essential. It's essential that people are able to share their values so that their loved ones understand. In addition, this form is updated to make sure that in the appointment of a healthcare representative section, that the healthcare representative accepts the appointment, so that those conversations are occurring at the time that the healthcare representative accepts the appointment. There's a dialogue between the patient and a loved one. Today, I could point Nick as my healthcare representative and he could get a phone call out of the blue saying, Jessica would like you to make healthcare representations for her, and he would have no idea what I intended. That doesn't serve patients, nor does it serve the individual that's been put in that situation, because that's asking them to make really critical decisions without information or without complete understanding of what the individual wants. This will improve that communication. Last but not least, this form, as Chana has mentioned, makes sure that it updates the list of people that can serve as witnesses. Today, if an individual is about ready to go into a surgery and we know that surgery is risky, that they may not wake up, or they may wake up in a state, they may come out of the surgery in a state where they are incapacitated, they're given the opportunity to fill out an advance directive so that we understand what their wishes are. But finding someone to witness that document becomes very difficult because of the list of people who are not allowed to witness this form. You have to find somebody who does not know you, who is not a medical professional, is not working in a medical facility to witness the form, and it is an ongoing challenge to do this. This will allow a notary to witness the form and allow that to serve as a mechanism to allow the advance directive to become effective. All of these things will serve consumers better, and we appreciate your time and interest in this bill.
Thank you. And Chris.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Hamilton. I am a Salem area attorney practicing in elder law and estate planning at the firm of McGinty Belcher in Hamilton. I'm here at the request of the Oregon State Bar to add some clarification on a few issues that were brought to their concern as or to their attention as concerns. My written testimony has already been entered, so I'm just going to hit a couple of brief points, and then I'm open for any questions that you would like to ask. 3 years ago, the bar started working on this with the work group that was put together out of the Judiciary Committee's Advanced Directive Work Group to improve this form and get this legislation moving. Representatives from the Elder Law Section and the Estate Planning Administration Section have participated in that work group throughout the process. The bar's interest and involvement is to review legal and technical issues. The bar is not taking a position on the policies involved. They just want to make sure that the legislation that's put together does what it says it's supposed to be doing. A large part of the practice of elder law and estate planning attorneys is discussing these exact issues and preparing these types of documents with our clients. Our section members shared concerns from our clients regarding the document that currently stands in statute being very difficult to use and frequently not addressing the concerns that individuals have and not addressing their most important wishes regarding their end of life. And the focus of the bar in being involved in this process was to make sure that the document is clearly written to allow Oregonians to express their wishes as easily and succinctly as possible.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Lithcom.
With regard to your point about the healthcare representative in the conversation and all of that, the legislation bill in front of us says that the healthcare representative must accept the appointment. And then there's a hierarchy of first, second, third, fourth. Can you describe how that flushes out?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Lithicum, the purpose of having alternates is because over time, while you may appoint, say, a spouse today and then maybe your children, it could be 20 or 30 years before you need to use that form. And our hope is that that is, in fact, what's occurring, that people are filling these out well in advance of a time that may be necessary. What the priority order does is you start with the first person, but if that person is unable or unwilling at that moment in time, or perhaps that was your spouse at the time, but you are no longer they're no longer together, you may have a spouse that's unwilling or an ex-spouse that's no longer willing to serve in that capacity. So you move down the list to be able to find somebody who is able to do that at any point. That person can be changed out. Somebody can make a decision later on to add somebody else or take somebody off of their list. And again, the healthcare representative at that moment in time can also choose not to proceed in acting in that capacity, but they do need to accept that appointment, and that acceptance can happen in a number of ways. They can do it in person by signing it. They can do it over the phone and have that be documented. There's lots of different ways that a person can choose to accept.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to that, I've got two questions, if I may. One is with regard to the verbal you referred to, and there's a number of ways to document. How would that verbal telephone conversation, quote, get documented? And let me bleed that into the next follow-on. In your current spouse, new spouse scenario, if this document isn't updated, is it true that the first spouse has priority because she was the only one on the form or whatever, and there's this verbal communication on the second spouse, and there's, you know, how to flesh out how you would translate who gets priority, who's in charge here, et cetera, because the one that's on the form is not the verbal one, and this documentation scenario sounds fuzzy.
So I'm going to turn to my legal colleague to talk about that.
Good call for the lifeline.
So if you have an advance directive in place that names the ex-spouse, in a perfect world, you'll have talked with an attorney before doing that or as part of doing that, and there will also be a caveat on there that says, if I am no longer married to this person, this does not apply. We don't live in a perfect world, so you're not going to end up with that form and have that same problem still. That individual is the appointed healthcare representative. The odds of an ex-spouse wanting to step up if there's been an estranged relationship or there's a problem are fairly low.
The reality, if they're on first position and they don't update the form, law is going to go with the first person. They're going to have to reject that assignment. But I mean, that's the same thing with just like a will. I mean, it's anytime you want to refocus who you're going to bequest whatever to, you need to be talking to the legal people to make those changes or modifying your forms.
If I may, using that scenario again, just pretend there is no second spouse. First spouse rejects the assignment. Who steps in at that point? Because there's no second alternate, third alternate, fourth alternate, et cetera.
So if there are no alternates listed within the appointment, then the statute itself provides a prioritized list of people we think you're most likely to have wanted to step into that role.
Right.
And so we would refer to that list, figure out who we have available, and that's how we would decide who's making decisions.
So at that point, you would be stepping to the current ORS and referring to the family member in that hierarchy. I'm not sure where it's actually found, but...
And if I may add to that, this also underscores the importance of the instruction section. So to the extent that an instruction is clear and specific, that would also inform and guide decision-making. And any surrogate, whether appointed as a healthcare representative or by default in the statute, would be bound legally and ethically to follow instructions.
Okay, just for the record, that ORS is 127.635 paren 2. But
All right. Starting with Senator Bentz and then Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for all your work on this most important document. So on page 13 of the 4135, up in line 5, there's a deletion of the reference to out-of-state executed forms. And the assertion has been made that this means that now the out-of-state form would take precedence over Oregon law. Is that correct?
If I may, Chair Przanski, Senator Bentz, no, it is not. The appointment of a representative in an out-of-state form and any instructions in that form that would be compatible with Oregon law are to be honored, and that's actually a requirement that we're given by the federal constitution that we be recognizing other states' laws. But it does not give the ability to give authority outside of what Oregon law allows an advance directive to do or allows a healthcare representative to do under ORS 127. The authority comes from the statute itself, not from the form.
And a follow-up. The language, the deletion of the language which read, may be given effect in accordance with its provisions subject to the laws of this state. That was deleted because that was surplusage then? Is that why that was taken out?
Yes.
So just to state for the record and intent and all that, if someone arrives in Oregon with an out-of-state directive that's different than that which Oregon law requires, Oregon law would prevail?
Yes, Senator.
Okay. Second question.
Yes.
It's been suggested that that the language we find back in the Savings Clause on page 29 is inadequate to reflect the fact, I hope, that the law in effect at the time the directive is executed is the law that would apply in trying to figure out how that directive is to be interpreted. So the question is, what is the meaning of the language found on page 29 in I think probably all of 1-2 in section 31, paragraphs 1 and 2?
So just for the record, starting on line 19?
Correct. Thank you. And continuing down to line 34.
Chair Przanski, Senator Bentz, the intent of that section is to say that if an advance directive has been completed in any form that was approved by Oregon law at the time that it was completed, that advance directive will be honored.
Okay, and the follow-up.
So let's just clarify that. So in other words, if somehow we update our forms, whatever was already executed, what already has been completed, will stay and have full effect.
Correct.
All right, Senator Bentz.
Yes, thank you. The question, I think, is if the law has changed from the time that one has executed a perfectly valid directive, which law would apply to determine its correct application? Would it be the law as amended, or would it be the law in effect at the time the document was executed?
I'm going to have to answer that with a question to make sure I understand what you're asking.
Yeah.
So is the question looking at if for some reason litigation were to come up over the implementation of the advance directive, do we look back to law in effect when the advance directive was signed, or do we look to current Oregon law?
Nicely put.
And generally in that circumstance, we would be looking to current Oregon law to interpret the advance directive.
And the follow-up.
Yes.
Is that a change from the current statute?
Not to my knowledge.
And is that because we've only had one statute over the last, 20 years?
23.
Therefore,
plus.
Yeah.
That would be part of it, yes.
So your question, so it's correct to say then that the assertions that have been made that although you would sign something in 2010 and then we changed the law in 2020, you would not be assured that your wishes would be followed or directions followed because we've changed the law that's applicable to your instructions given 10 years earlier. That's what you're saying. The new law would apply to the old directive is what you're saying.
Yes, Senator.
I think, let me ask for clarification. I'm thinking whether or not there's a conflict that would be between what was signed and what was in effect at the time versus what changes. I think that would have to come into play as compared to just saying if there's a change in the law, automatically it changes. There's got to be a conflict, is what I would assume. And wouldn't it also be that you would have, if you changed, let's going with wills, if you had a will and you had a statute that was changed, the will that's been signed would still have effect, but if it's been modified by the new law, isn't that when attorneys are reaching out to their clients and saying there's been this change in law, you may want to come in and address those concerns?
Follow
full
up.
Service.
Follow up?
Yes.
I may. So I've done hundreds of these.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I have no idea how many of my law firm has done. I've lost track over these 20 years or whatever it is. And I would suggest that most people didn't understand the form. So your efforts, or our efforts, to make the form more clear are welcome. Mm-hmm. What, though, I think is important is that if the rules that they thought they were giving in 2010 change, most of them are not going to come zooming back down to my office to get a new one done. A, they won't know about the change, and B, they wouldn't understand it, and C, they don't want to pay me. So what they would be worried about is that as they understood the law at the time, as best I could have explained it to them, they would want those rules to apply 10 years later after we'd changed all the rules. So what I'm trying to get at here is, does this new statute then apply to govern difficulties? Well, actually, the going right to the heart of the matter, maybe we're going to change it to expand the power of the attorney in fact. And maybe they don't want that to happen. Maybe they're perfectly happy with the narrow power now given. And then 10 years later, we give the attorney, in fact, more power. Which of the laws applies? The broader power 10 years later or the limited power 10 years earlier when they signed it? Which applies under that which we're discussing today? Which law?
Senator, to give you a full answer on that, I'm going to have to get back to you.
And follow up. And I appreciate that. When I read the language, I read it like a lot, many times, and I could not figure it out. So that's why I'm asking. But thank you.
Right. Senator Wagner.
So just a question on context here. Obviously, since the statute was originally developed, there have been significant advances in end-of-life medical technology around life support. And I would just be interested on what do other states do in terms of best practices around this sort of form? Is it written into statute, or is there sufficient flexibility that we find either through rulemaking or through a different process? What would you say, maybe even from an ethicist's point of view, is sort of best practice?
Well, just as a Senator Wagner, Chair, as an ethicist, I'm also mindful that my competency is not the law. But what I have observed is a range of approaches to advanced care planning and advanced directives in different states, ranging from specifying the form in statute, as in Oregon, to specifying minimum requirements for what the form would constitute in, say, California, to any sort of open-ended any instruction or designation, and this is also correlative to the standards of evidence that are applicable in that state, so preponderance of evidence or clear and convincing evidence, as was established in Cruzan. You know, one of the best practices that we've referenced a number of times is the best wishes document. Again, it's a form, a process by which individuals can explore the values underlying their particular advanced care planning, advanced directive instructions. So I would say that the best practice is anytime you can get to a values-based orientation to a specific preference would be the gold standard.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel will include Calm Willis as well as Karen Goodness. Who'd like to start off? I think you've been drafted.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, I guess I'm not here today. Members of this committee, my name is Cullen Willis. I'm an attorney with Lynch, Conger, McLean, and I'm here at the request of Oregon Right to Life to ask you to oppose House Bill 4135. If this bill is enacted without amendment, the legal authority of a healthcare representative in the state of Oregon would change to allow a healthcare representative to make a life-ending decision for an incapable person without his or her specific prior written consent in situations where a healthcare representative currently does not have this authority under the law. And there's been some confusion about out-of-state advance directives and the impact this bill will have on those. Some of the proponents of the bill have been pointing to ORS 127.642, which requires caregivers provide reasonable assistance with food and fluids to an incapable person at the end of life. However, as I'm sure the members of this committee know, since an advance directive is an exercise of a constitutional liberty interest by an individual to refuse medical treatment, it overrides statutory or regulatory requirements on caregivers to provide medical treatment. So under Oregon law, spoon feeding is not considered medical treatment, but laws in other states governing advance directives are not as clear on this point. That's why it's important that advance directives executed in another state are interpreted and governed by Oregon law. And there's some disagreement as to whether this bill ensures that. For these reasons, we respectfully ask that you oppose House Bill 4135.
All right, Karen.
I believe you've all read my testimony. I took care of my mother for 3.5 years. I came up from 20 years living in Hawaii. I took care of her with dementia and Alzheimer's. I saw the gradual decline. And before she passed, 3 weeks before she passed, I'll just repeat this part. She wasn't able to speak. She was on lorazepam and morphine. Her body starting to go downhill, where you start to see a lack of circulation and so on. Anyway, all of a sudden, 12 o'clock at night, and she'd only been hallucinating up until that point, like, who are those people sitting in the chair? And I like that orchestra, and the guy sounds really has a good voice, but, you know, she's trying to sleep, and she's hearing all these things. So all of a sudden she says, I need the courage to reach out to Jesus. Can this be the year we go to Hawaii? I was talking to Jesus about my foot. I told him I followed all the instructions, and if you have any crosses left over, drop them in the box. So she actually spoke about her passing on Palm Sunday. So somehow there's a spirit alive and well inside of her, but clinically speaking, I'm really not sure if there's proper brain waves going on. It's totally bypassing logic that she even survived the 3 weeks to get to that point. Anyway, so I appreciate all of your efforts to work on this complicated issue. To me, the bill is so complicated, and what if you speak Spanish? And what if the next of kin moves away or they're on vacation? How does anybody find this information unless it's in some kind of a database? And so basically, you have the testimony. Let's see. So basically, I said no one should decide to withhold food and water. They can still feel pain, of course. And what does this remove or change the advance directive that a person chose? Oh, yeah, that to me sounded a little bit scary to change the advance directive. And I think it's a problem that people, first of all, most people in Oregon aren't even aware of this. I mean, what about Nicholas Anderson? He was in a motorcycle accident, and he's doing quite well. So the thing is, how do you decide? Do you take a test on the brain waves? What's going on to let people know if Nicholas Anderson is going to make it? You know, how long do you wait? So those things. And does this apply to other things besides dementia and Alzheimer's? Does it apply to just anybody that might have had a stroke or something? Or they're temporarily incapacitated? Where do you draw the line on this?
Is that concludes your testimony?
Well, yeah, I have that question. Yeah, sure.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the panel? I want to thank both of you for coming forward. Thank you very much. Our next panel will include Sabrina Riggs, Elizabeth Rimley, and Andy Easton.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sabrina Riggs, representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association, or OSAA. OSAA is comprised of over 20 emergency services providers across the state. They include both publicly and privately owned companies, as well as ground and air emergency first responder and transport services. As you may imagine, our members are frequently on scene during critical, potentially end-of-life moments. I'm here to express the association's support of House Bill 4135. As you've undoubtedly been made aware, the current advance directive form is quite outdated and can be confusing for patients. I was very surprised to learn it's not been updated since before I was born. OSAA members respond daily to emergency calls at homes, hospices, nursing facilities, and while providing interfacility transport to critical medical situations at the end of a life. These events require rapid evaluation of the patient's condition, as well as existing medical orders, including pulsed advance directives and other forms of DNARs. As well as the wishes of loved ones who may be on the scene. Our aim is to always honor the patient's wishes for their end-of-life care. Due to our members' unique and frequent encounters involving the advance directive form, we believe that we may provide a valuable perspective in the proceedings of an advance directive advisory committee. While we are not listed as an official member on the advisory committee, we do hope that these meetings are at least a partially public process that we can lend our expertise to. Finally, I'd like to thank the proponents and sponsors of this important bill. The State Ambulance Association is looking forward to participating in conversations that will lead to an updated, easily understandable, and patient-friendly advance directive form. I can take any questions if you've got them.
All right, thank you. We'll take the rest of the testimony. Elizabeth, you're going next.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, Elizabeth Rimley here today on behalf of Cambia Health Solutions. I also have another client who is in support of this bill, the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. So doing double duty here today. But on behalf of Cambia, who's been involved, Cambia Health Solutions got involved in this process early. They, the history of their involvement is that they take on sort of internal projects to try to streamline the health care provisions for their members. They're the largest, they're the parent company of Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is the largest commercial insurance company in the state by covered lives. And they take on projects to try to figure out how to streamline coverage and care options for their members, their customers. And they focused on palliative care a couple of years ago. It's a part of healthcare that's not particularly well studied. There's not a lot of sort of medical research around what's effective care. It's often left kind of out of anybody's consideration when they're choosing health plans. And so they were looking at, you know, how do we make sure that palliative care is available in all of its forms to members? How do we cover it correctly? And then how do we make sure that people can access it? And one of the things that they found was that many, many people were not finishing their advance directive, not being able to express their wishes, even if they had the coverage that they needed from our perspective on health insurance. So we got involved with the Advance Directive Initiative to try to update it. That's where we came into this process. We're incredibly supportive of the work group. We appreciate Chair Przanski's leadership for the last 4 years in trying to figure this out. The task force that he assembled was a multidisciplinary task force full of tons of experts from all kinds of fields trying to figure this out, including the Legislative Council, Ted Falk, who wrote the original Advance Directive. He was there the whole time to give us all the historical context we could need. So we're here today to support this bill. We appreciate all of your work on this and all of your thought over the years. This bill's been before the Senate. I think this is the fourth time now. Some of you are new, but some of you have seen this four times. So with that, I'll be glad to answer questions.
All right. Thank you. Andy?
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm Andy Easton, representing Oregon's Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and here before you today in support of House Bill 4135. Oftentimes, hospitals are the front line of where advance directives are either distributed to our patients as they come into our facilities and ask to be filled out, or oftentimes they are the executors of the advance directives. The advance directives provides an open communication, a critical communication tool for patients who are not conscious, unable to speak for themselves. It gives their provider and their care team a clear direction as to how that patient's healthcare wishes want to be delivered and carried out. So we are very supportive of this bill. We appreciate the work of the work group that has gone on. They've been very thoughtful in taking many years and getting to where we are today. So we are very appreciative of that, and we do support House Bill 4135 and ask that for your support as well.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Ladies, thank you very much for coming forward. That concludes the individuals that have signed up for the witness registration sheet. Is there anyone else who has not signed up, who has not given testimony this morning, that wanted to give testimony on House Bill 4135? Not seeing any, we'll close the public hearing on the House Bill 4135, and wondering if we have all the paperwork and stuff. All right, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 4135, and ask for Senator Denborough to give us a motion on that bill.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of House Bill 4135, and that it be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Denborough moves for the passage of House Bill 4135 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Let's open it up for discussion. Senator Lethe, come first.
One question I never asked the bar, and the staff may know, so it's just fine. The terminology ratified that shows up in with regard to the legislature's ability to change the form and, quote, get ratified, I'm not familiar with that. Can you explain that process?
Chair Przanski, Senator Linthicum, members of the committee. So the The idea here is that the ADEC, the committee, will bring forward an idea. This is what we have decided. It's been subject to public testimony in the rules process over at the Oregon Health Authority. It now comes to the legislature. They present it to the committee, and then the legislature files a measure based upon what was brought by the ADEC. From there, it is treated as a normal measure, and the ratification is the normal process that the legislature has to go through in order to pass a measure.
Okay, just in clarification, the legislature doesn't, other than that committee and whatnot, where that wording and language is getting worked out and thought through in a diligent fashion, the legislature doesn't really contribute to that approval or disapproval other than the ratification process.
Senator Linthicum, on the front end, no, but once it's here before the legislature, you are able to act on it as
okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Last session, occasions and compromise, working with one of the groups as to wanting to ensure that we, the legislature, would actually have to take an affirmative action on whatever is being proposed as changes to the rural or the farm. And the way my understanding is that this committee will have over 2 years. To bring back to the legislature their suggestions for modifying and making the temporary form better. But we, the legislature, will have to take that information. We'll go through the same process as we have with any other type of legislation and would require the ratifications through an affirmative vote, both on both chambers and the signature of the governor for it to actually go into effect. Senator Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I share the concern over the language that's in HB 4135 regarding the authority of the committee. I appreciate the need for the committee, but the language that's used when it, the word adopt on line 45 on page 2 and the word adopt on line 1. All of those, and there's some other words that make it, generally those would have been suggest or put forward, as opposed to using these words that sound so final. And I was disturbed with those words, but your statement of intent helps dramatically, because I don't want to give this kind of power to any non-elected group. But I have a question, and this is reflective of the fact that I've come pretty late to this particular discussion, and I'm unhappy about that, but that's where I am. But apparently someone over in the House said that there would be situations where the healthcare representative could make life-ending decisions under this bill that would not be allowed under current law. Is that correct? I've gone through this thing a couple of times. I was not able to find that expansion of power, but someone in the House apparently thought that. Is it your intent of having worked on this for so long that this bill does not expand the authority that a healthcare representative would have under current law?
That is my perspective and my belief, my understanding, and through the work group, what we're attempting to do is give clarity to the current form that we have that's been in existence for over 23 years. As we've heard from the testimony today, many individuals become very frustrated and not sure as to what this means or how it's put forward. That's what this ongoing work group has done. And now, basically, at this point, clearly whatever is controlling under Oregon law will, in fact, be the measure for us as we would be looking for interpretations through this process. Clearly, the situation that we have gone through, and as I've put on the record, is that whatever adoption into the form of what they want to see is going to have to come back. And I'll give you an example of just the alternative of this is a post document where you actually have a committee that actually has the ability to not only make recommendations, but actually put in place what will be the changes to that form. And unless the legislature takes an affirmative action of bringing that measure before us, for consideration. It's posted on the website saying that it will go in effect on this date unless the legislature takes an action to, I guess, review it and maybe make modifications. In this particular case, there is not that a path. The agreement that we made this last time in this the form of the bill currently in House Bill 4135 is virtually the same with a few technical changes, but the substances have not. Basically will in fact require I'm going to call it an affirmative vote by both chambers, just as if it was it will have to be have to be introduced as a bill for those modifications to change the temporary form into the permanent form. And then after that, as we go forward, the committee will be able to meet, and every 4 years they will bring back whatever recommendations that they have for making changes. And again, the legislature will have to take that up in bill form and make changes through that process. So not only will we have a shot, quote unquote, of looking at it and reviewing it and modifying it the first time, any changes in the future will come to us in the even number of years for us to be able to take those considerations. And if the legislature, whoever's here at that time, chooses to go forward with those recommendations, then at that point there will be a bill before that sitting legislature to make those changes.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions or comments? Any objection to the motion that we have before us?
I'm going to object also for reasons that we heard when it comes to out-of-state issues. I'm anxious to see what is forthcoming in the answer to that, but for the moment, it'll be a no.
All right. So at this point, the record should stand that Senator Lithicum and Senator Bentz are in opposition. I'm assuming there is no other opposition, and that being the case, motion carries, and the bill will go forward to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Chair will carry.
We may consider a minority report.
House Bill 4135. At this time, I'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 4135, and I'm now going to open up a work session on House Bill 4145A. Chana?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 4145A, you heard yesterday. This expands the prohibition on possession of firearms to include those who are under a court order or having a qualifying conviction related to a family or household member rather than an intimate partner. It also includes a conviction of stalking within that prohibition. And then the second half of the measure requires the Oregon State Police to enter qualifying convictions in terms of the judgment in the appropriate state and federal law enforcement databases and to send reports of attempted purchases by prohibited individuals to the appropriate law enforcement entities and then to submit a report once a year on the outcome of those reports.
All right, thank you. Senator Denbrough?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4145A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Denbrough moves for House Bill 4145A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Lithicum first.
I just have one question for staff. If and when this law were to go into effect, would it be retroactive for individuals that have stalking convictions?
Senator Lithicum, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I believe that it would not, as it applies to possession of firearms or ammunition occurring on or after the effective date.
But Mr. Chair, but if somebody had a stalking order in advance, and so
the predicates stay. In other words, if it's a predicate type of crime, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Then they would come under the authority of this law, right?
So, Senator Denbrough, to clarify, if a person was under a stalking order right now that qualified within this measure and this law came into effect and they were then in possession of firearm or ammunition, yes, but it wouldn't reach back to people who are no longer under that order, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
But people who are currently under a stalking order
that was in effect prior to the establishment of the law, at any point somebody is under a stalking order.
Correct.
That would apply.
That's still in effect.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions? All right, any objection to the motion of moving House Bill 4145A to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Okay. Senator Lithicum, Senator Bentz, is there anyone else in objection? Not seeing anyone. Motion carries. It's on its way to the floor. Chair will carry 4145A to the floor, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 4145A. That concludes the work we have today. I believe we're scheduled for tomorrow at 8:30. Yeah.
30.
All right, so we're going to give back a little bit of time for the last couple of days. So we will be here tomorrow, 8:30, and we're adjourned. Thank you.